Hello and welcome to the Master of Demon Gorge podcast. Today we're talking about Yangtze River number 1. In September 2002, an old man lay dying in a room at Datong Hospital in the city of Kaohsiung in southern Taiwan. His name was Li Tiesheng, and he was 87 years old. No doubt, the doctors and nurses saw all the scars that covered his body. If anyone looked at his hands, they might have also noticed that something odd had happened to them, so that they were bent out of shape. But these were not the reason he was in the hospital. Rather, he had a cardiac tumor, as well as pneumonia. It didn't look like he was going to make it. Not this time. Family members gathered around him. So did old friends and former colleagues. And so did reporters. Some mere enthusiasts in the history of China in the Second World War even showed up at his hospital room hoping to see him. Someone leaned in and asked Li Tiesheng, Mr. Li, will you please tell us once and for all, are you or are you not Yangtze River number 1? Li Tiesheng was from Hebei in northern China, the province surrounding Beijing. I've actually not been able to find a source that squarely says when he was born, although this was not unusual for his generation, in part because at the time, both the traditional lunar calendar and the Western calendar were in use, making dates rather confusing. I remember with my grandparents, it was similarly difficult to work out their birthdays. But if he was 87 in 2002, we can surmise that he was born in 1915, assuming the modern way of reckoning. He was an only son. Under Chinese tradition, that meant that his life was extremely valuable to the family, because he would bear sole responsibility for continuing the bloodline and passing on the surname. In 1937, Li Tiesheng graduated from the Hebei No. 7 Normal College. We should note here that in early 20th century China, higher education was a rare privilege. Anyone who finished high school was considered well-educated. Even just being able to read puts you ahead of most of your fellow citizens. So Li Tiesheng was what people at the time would have called a 知青 or educated youth. And 1937 was, of course, a pivotal year in the history of modern China. On July 7th of that year, Japan formally launched its full-scale invasion of China with the so-called Marco Polo Bridge incident. Much like in Ukraine early last year, young men and women all across China rushed to join the resistance, including 3 of my 4 grandparents. Li Tiesheng also wanted to go, but his family was against it. As I said, only son. If he went and volunteered to fight, his odds of coming home alive were not great. But young Li Tiesheng insisted. He had to put his country ahead of himself, ahead even of his own family. His family tearfully relented, and he went and enrolled in the Central Military Academy, commonly known as the Huangpu Military Academy, after its location in the province of Guangdong, just like both of my grandfathers. We should be clear, though. Enrolling in Huangpu did not mean that he went to Huangpu, the physical campus of the academy in Guangdong. The government of the Republic of China at this time was signing up young cadets up and down the country and training them wherever they could, and sometimes even on the move as Chinese forces retreated in the face of Japanese onslaught and as civilians turned into refugees. All of these cadets, as long as they trained under instruction from the central military, would be considered Huangpu men. In any event, Li Tiesheng graduated after a year of training and was now an officer of the Army of the Republic. Even during training, though, and inexplicably in the minds of some of his friends, he had already opted to specialize in intelligence work. Inexplicable to some, because intelligence was the most dangerous branch of the service. A young officer going into this line of work could generally expect his career to end fairly quickly in horrible torture and an early, unmarked grave. But it was what Li Tiesheng wanted. And upon graduation, he took up an intelligence post on the banks of the Yangtze River. So this was now 1938. The top headlines in the course of the war so far for the Chinese had been the fall of northern China, the bitter defense of Shanghai, ending in the destruction of one-third of the Chinese army, and the rape of Nanjing, during which Japanese soldiers massacred hundreds of thousands of Chinese civilians. The Chinese had enjoyed the psychological boost of the victory at Taizhuang, the first battle in this war that the Chinese actually won, which took place in March and April of 1938. But the big picture of the war was that the Japanese Imperial Army was, at this point, marching into the central Chinese province of Hubei, with its metropolis of Wuhan, at this time the second largest city in China. The Republican government's strategy at this time, which was of course the strategy it ended up implementing, was to withdraw to southwestern China and to make the city of Chongqing in Sichuan its wartime capital. But it wasn't just a matter of relocating the top echelons of the government. The idea was also to move a large portion of China's industrial base to the southwest, as well as the surviving army. Moving an industrial base meant literally disassembling entire factories and transporting the machinery across hundreds of miles of often difficult terrain. If you recall our episode on Sun Yongxuan, who later rose to the position of premier in Taiwan, you may recall that during this stage of the war, he was in charge of doing exactly that, packing up entire power stations and transporting the machines by donkey carts halfway across China. None of this was easy or could be done quickly. So, for the moment, the center of the Republic's government, military, and economic potential remained in Wuhan. And if the Japanese Imperial Army could attack and annihilate the Chinese forces then and there, then the war would be as good as over. Japan would have won before war in Europe had even begun. It was to slow the Japanese advance in June 1938 that the Republican government voluntarily breached the Yellow River and flooded a large section of central China, killing hundreds of thousands of their own citizens. We've talked about this incident in passing on this podcast already, and it remains controversial. How does a government weigh the lives of individual citizens against the cause of national survival? But it's not the main crux of today's episode, so we'll set it aside for now. A second measure the Chinese took at this time to slow the Japanese advance was to scuttle a series of ships along the Yangtze River and to mine a large section of it to make it impossible for the Japanese to cross the river. Side note here, remember that what in English is called the Yangtze River is called Changjiang or the Long River in Chinese. Yangtze in Chinese refers only to a portion of the Long River. But for purposes of this episode, we'll go with international usage and call it the Yangtze River. So, as I said, at this time, in 1938, Li Tiesheng threw himself into espionage. Specifically, he was the station chief of an intelligence outpost on the banks of the Yangtze, codenamed Swift Wind. My guess is that that's a reference to a passage in Sun Tzu's Art of War. Therefore, be ye swift like the wind, gentle like the forest, ferocious like fire, and still like the mountain. And as the leader of this local network of intelligence operatives, a monumental task now fell on his shoulders. A task codenamed Operation Dead Bridge. See, the Chinese obviously could not mine and barricade the entire length of the Yangtze River. They blocked off a central section, but the Japanese Imperial Army could go around it. Accordingly, the Japanese began moving toward the county of Jianli in the province of Hubei, some 200 kilometers upriver from Wuhan, where they knew it was still possible to make a crossing. Only about 5,000 Chinese troops were stationed in Jianli County, not nearly enough to stop the Japanese advance. But Jianli County was also where the Swift Wind Intelligence Station was located. In fact, for a time, the unit was headquartered in the house of a member of the local gentry surnamed Zhou. This will become relevant later. So, Operation Dead Bridge, of which Li Tiesheng was in charge, was to plant explosives on all the bridges in the area and then to blow them up at the right moment. I want to describe the operation to you as a blow-by-blow with all the tense details. I want to tell you how this spy went to set the detonator but got shot by the advance guard of the Japanese army, and how that spy ran up to replace him in a hail of bullets, careless of his own life. I want to tell it to you as a gripping spy story, an action adventure worthy of Hollywood. But I cannot, not as facts. I don't have those details. They are secret. And all the spies involved, at least those who survived, kept their mouths shut. Certainly, Li Tiesheng kept mum. But we do know that Li Tiesheng and his comrades succeeded. They blew up the bridges right as the Japanese advanced guard was crossing them, killing hundreds of enemy soldiers in the process. And we know that their success, his success, bought the Chinese Republic additional valuable time to relocate its personnel and its resources to the Southwest. And only because the Republic was able to do so, that it was also able to continue the struggle for another 7 years until Allied victory in 1945. Li Tiesheng and his small band of spies quite literally saved their country. Like I said, much of Li Tiesheng's espionage career remains a secret, so there's not much we can say for sure. We know he very nearly died in the course of his work a number of times. Once, when Li Tiesheng was traveling with several colleagues, the Japanese got wind of which hotel they were staying at. They went and caught every member of his group, except him, and proceeded to execute them all, either by firing squad or by burying them alive. Once, in the middle of something like a dinner party, an informant for the Japanese, fingered him as a Chinese spy in front of everyone. Li Tiesheng somehow managed to talk his way out. Twice, the Japanese captured him, and they tortured him, hence all the scars on his body. The way his fingers were twisted out of shape, it was because the Japanese interrogators would bend his fingers with pliers. They also jammed bamboo sticks up his fingernails. But as with Operation Dead Bridge, details remain scarce. To tell a story of his life in detail, or the story of Operation Dead Bridge in detail, would require a fair amount of imagination, of fictionalizing. I'm not going to do that because I like to try to stick to facts here. But somebody did exactly that. In 1963, a novelist named Zhou Lang published a novel called Dead Bridge, telling a fictionalized version of Operation Dead Bridge. Zhou Lang, born in 1923, was too young to have been in the Chinese military in 1938, but he later joined the army, fought in the Civil War, then went to Hong Kong. From Hong Kong, he eventually went to Taiwan and settled there. Besides his day job in the ROC government, he wrote numerous works of spy fiction, which were very popular in their day, if largely forgotten now. And it may have already occurred to you, did I just say that his name was Zhou Lang? I did. And I also said that, for a time, the Swift Wind spy station was located in the home of a man surnamed Zhou. This gentleman was, in fact, the father of the novelist Zhou Lang. A teenaged Zhou Lang thus crossed paths with Li Tiesheng and his buddies right around the time when they were planning to blow up the bridges. And so the hero of Dead Bridge, perhaps Zhou Lang's most significant novel, was based on Li Tiesheng. And in the novel, Zhou Lang gave the protagonist a code name, Yangtze River Number 1. Although, of course, this was not the code name that Li Tiesheng used in real life. So the novel came out in 1963. A year earlier, in 1962, the first James Bond movie, Dr. No, opened in theaters in the US. The film only made it to Taiwan the following year, so as far as folks in Taiwan were concerned, it came out at the same time as the novel Dead Bridge. The second 007 film, From Russia with Love, arrived in Taiwan in 1964 and was even more popular than Dr. No. There followed a wave of interest in spy stories. So the movie producers came to Zhou Lang. Would he be interested in adapting his novel, Dead Bridge, into a film? Of course he was interested. And the government was also supportive of a local film celebrating the wartime heroism of ROC officers. The son of the president, then Minister of Defense, and future president, Jiang Jingguo, however, didn't like the novel's title, Dead Bridge. He suggested that they change it. In the end, the film that came out in 1969 was called Storm Over the Yangtze River, and Zhou Lang went back and retitled his novel as such. One thing that didn't change, though, was the hero's codename. In the movie, he was still called Yangtze River Number 1. And as the film took Taiwan and Hong Kong by storm, sweeping the local film awards as well as winning at the local box office, suddenly everyone knew the phrase Yangtze River Number 1. It became synonymous with Chinese James Bond. And It left everyone wondering, who was Yangtze River number one? Meanwhile, Li Tiesheng had gone to Taiwan with the ROC government following defeat in the civil war against the communists. And he still served in the army in Taiwan as the novel came out and then the film. When the film premiered, Defense Minister Jiang Jingguo personally invited him to go and see it together, leading to many whispers that perhaps he was the real-life Yangtze River number one. After the success of the film, a TV spin-off followed, in which the character Yangtze River number one was actually also named Li Tiesheng, leading most to conclude that he had to be the real-life war hero. A sequel film also followed, called simply Yangtze River number one, further impressing that phrase on the Taiwanese psyche. Interestingly, in 2008, in the PRC, they also made a TV show based on this story, also called Yangtze River number one. The real-life Li Tiesheng retired from military service in 1977 with the rank of Major General. For a few years, he took a job at the Environmental Bureau of the Kaohsiung Municipal Government, until finally retiring fully in 1983. During all the years after the film came out, friends and colleagues refer to him half-seriously as Yangtze River number one, but he would never confirm it one way or the other. Indeed, he never talked about his espionage career. His second son actually became a journalist, and even he couldn't get the truth out of his father. Over the years, there were also speculations that others might have been the real-life inspiration for Yangtze River number one, just as many names have been proposed as the real-life inspiration for James Bond. A man named Liu Yunqiao, for example, who was also a Chinese spy active during this time, in addition to being a master of the style of Kung Fu called Ba Ji Quan, was considered a possibility. But by the time Li Tiesheng lay dying in his hospital bed in September 2002, the consensus view was that he was it. Other officers like Liu Yunqiao, who retired as a colonel, also served bravely in their time, also had incredible stories to tell. But they were not the direct inspiration for Zhou Lang's novel and the resulting film. Still, everyone wanted to hear it from the horse's mouth. Hence, that final question as Li Tiesheng lay on his deathbed. Mr. Li, Mr. Li, are you or are you not Yangtze River number one? The 87-year-old Li Tiesheng, ventilator on his face, seemed to nod. But ultimately, he did not answer. True spies never tell. They take their secrets to the grave. This has been MODG. Thank you for listening.